federal linguists find themselves in a catch-22 situation. They become experts in another culture and another language by spending a lot of time living outside the country, but spending a lot of time outside the United States can make their security lives more difficult. Matthew Asada is state vice president of the American Foreign Service Association and here to explain the obstacles a federal linguist faces when he or she is trying to advance a career. Thank you very much for coming on today, Matthew. There's a particular program that people are finding themselves going into. Tell me about the situation that some of your members and folks at the State Department find themselves in. Thanks for being on today, Matthew.
Well, thanks, Francis, for having me. And at the front, I'd like just to say that we have about 15,000 members of the Foreign Service at the Department of State, half of which are officers, half of which are specialists, many of whom are language qualified. And these officers, our members, will spend the majority of their careers overseas in some of the hardest places serving this country. And actually, it's a requirement for some of these members in order to become confirmed as commissioned officers in the Foreign Service or to be promoted into the senior Foreign Service that they actually speak one, if not two, languages. So language skills are very important for our craft and for our line of work.
The sacrifices and work that Foreign Service officers make they're not known to a lot of people, and I'll discuss them later this hour with Ryan Crocker, whose work I'm sure you're familiar with. He'll be on the program about a half hour from now. But the language skills that your people have to get, as I mentioned, many times come about because they gain that knowledge and they gain that experience in the culture in which that language is spoken. What situation does that put them in security-wise that makes it difficult to move up in the world, Matthew?
Well, that's correct. Many people learn a foreign language when they're studying abroad, or perhaps they have family from a certain country, and they grow up with that language. Others are actually learning that foreign language here at the State Department at our Foreign Service Institute, which teaches more than 50 languages from around the world. The difficulty becomes, though, when you have someone that has maybe excellent language skills and is very familiar with the country and the region, and yet find themselves in the situation where they're unable to serve in that country or even to work on those issues here in Washington. And that's something that does not impact a lot of people. It's about 150 people right now in the Foreign Service. However, to that 1%, it really does make a difference because they're unable to use the language skills that they've developed over time to help further the interests of our country.
Now, my notes say that some of your members are denied job postings, as you have just talked about. I mean, they're flat out told you're not able to get this job. What are the reasons behind those, and what are the implications for others who are going to try to follow in their footsteps?
Well, every Foreign Service employee is required to maintain a security clearance, and that's something that all of us believe very strongly in. However, it may be the case that somebody has different influence because of their time overseas, the contacts that they've developed, perhaps their family members that they have. And these foreign influences will be considered when their security clearance is reviewed. The problem, though, is that the security clearance process, it has a lot of procedural protections built in for employees. So in the instance that you are denied a security clearance, you can actually appeal that to somebody outside of that office. And they'll take a look at it and make a determination as to whether or not that decision was correct. However, in the instance of these assignment restrictions or preclusions, unfortunately, there is no independent appeals process. And so therefore, you have one office that has made a determination, and that there's no way for the employee to challenge that. And that's one of the largest reforms that we would like to see through this process, a meaningful appeals process for the employee with procedural rights.
Who has to act to change that, Matthew? Is that something that can be changed internally in the State Department, or is that something that requires legislation from Congress?
Well, this is something that we have spoken with the secretary, the deputy secretary, the undersecretary here at the Department of State about. And I think that there's an awareness and appreciation for this issue and this challenge. And right now, the department is seeing how it might be able to handle this internally. And there's some real receptiveness to doing that. At the same time, we know our friends on the Hill, both sides of the aisle, have expressed interest in this issue. And so that they, in past draft authorizations, for instance, they've looked at including a section that would talk about assignment restrictions and preclusions. But at this point in time, it is something that is within the discretionary authorities of the Department of State to remedy and to reform to make it better for the employee and the agency, and most importantly, for the American people.
Matthew Assad is Vice President of the State Department at the American Foreign Service Association. Matthew, you mentioned before we went on the air that this is something that's been on your radar screen for several years now. Is this a new phenomenon that you've been following throughout its entirety, or is this something that people have been dealing with for a long time and only a critical mass has only happened to draw your attention in the last couple of years? Or what's the timeline trajectory of this look like?
Well, this has been an issue out there for some time now, but I think you're right that it's reached a critical mass, that we have now employees that have come to us, that have come to other affinity groups within the Department of State and say, hey, this is a real concern. Your experience sounds very much like my experience that we went through, and perhaps we can do something about it. And we also have a very receptive department management at this time that's looking at how can we address some of these issues? How can we promote employee diversity? How can we ensure that we have all of our language-designated positions overseas staffed with language speakers? So it's this constellation that's kind of come up right now that's providing us with an opportunity to take another look at this issue.
And you kind of anticipated my next question, which is, what is the overall tenor, in your sense, of the relationship between the workforce and the management at the State Department? It sounds like it's pretty healthy right now overall.
Well, I think right now we are fortunate to have Secretary Kerry, who cares very much about the institution. At the end of the day, diplomacy is about our people here in Washington helping to make the policy, our people overseas helping to implement it. And he's committed to developing that workforce and to addressing some of these employee concerns. But if I could just relay, you know, a personal story, I'm a fourth-generation Japanese-American. You know, 70-plus years ago, my grandparents, my Japanese-American grandparents, were interned in internment camps because of their ethnic origin. But at that time, we still found ways for others, Japanese Americans, to fight and to serve in World War II in some of the toughest places. And today, we need to ensure that every American is able to contribute his or her skill set to help forward the interests of American diplomacy. And I think that for me, this really is a personal issue. Although I'm not impacted by this program, it's something that we have to stand up for, that every employee, regardless of where they come from, is able to serve their country.
What is the bottom line here? What would you like to see happen next in order to move this forward? Or is the resolution that you suggested earlier in our conversation, Matthew, really the only thing that remains to be done? Is that the big next step?
Well, again, we continue our conversations with the department leadership, with our friends in the Senate, with friends at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. What we'd like to see is a meaningful appeals process so that if you're and there may be very valid reasons for you to have an assignment restriction, for instance, if your family member was in the government of another country. However, we need to ensure that there's an appeals mechanism, that employees can say, wait a second, this looks like it really doesn't apply to me. I really don't have any family in that country, or that person's passed away. There should be some way to appeal the decision. There also needs to be more done for reporting and oversight. How many employees are affected by this? How often are these cases appealed? What can be done to ensure that we're recruiting more people with, you know, the required languages? Because, frankly, sometimes we've been recruiting people with language skills that are then precluded from serving in those countries in which those languages could be used. But finally, the third element is just improved communications with our employees. Again, everyone comes here, again, really eager to serve their country. And for someone to receive a letter, you know, 6 weeks into the job saying, yes, I know you've studied Korean for 3 years. Yes, I know you've worked there and you have developed real experience, but now you're going to be unable to use that, that's a little demoralizing. And it may cause people here in the service to consider other places of employment. And that's something we would definitely want to avoid.